should Jacksonville best develop its underutilized riverfront? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, the group Riverfront Parks Now challenges the city's developer class with another vision for the St. John's Riverfront. Let us know your thoughts. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, some good news for your midweek. It's our What's Good Wednesdays. But first this hour, the latest numbers on the pandemic. On Tuesday, the state reported coronavirus cases in Florida increased to 1.837 million. Hospitalizations went down, but deaths rose to a total grim tally of 29,154. But the number of vaccinations is ticking up. That's good news. About 2.4 million Florida residents have gotten at least one jab of either the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine. Okay, we're going to turn now to the big local story of today in Jacksonville. This afternoon, the city's Downtown Investment Authority is going to consider a proposal to grant Shad Khan's company, Iguana Investments, access to the Kids Campus parcel on the north bank of the St. John's River. The purpose? To conduct environmental testing on the site. They need to do that before any commercial development can happen there. According to the Florida Times Union, Iguana and the Jaguars want to build a Four Seasons hotel on the Kids Campus property. Now, Kids Campus is not protected by the city's standing agreement with the National Park Service to keep parkland on the St. John's North Bank from being commercially developed. That agreement covers just about 14 acres next to WJCT, where I'm sitting. It's commonly referred to as the Festival Lawn. Now, that Festival Lawn in the Kids Campus stretches about 23 acres along the river. In its heyday, the spot hosted everything from the city's Jazz Fest to the Symphony's Starry Nights and a bevy of outdoor music festivals. But here's the latest on all this. Riverfront Parks Now, a growing coalition of nearly a dozen civic groups representing thousands of local voters, is asking the public to oppose the DIA resolution. They've developed an alternative vision for the St. John's Downtown North Bank, and it's one they say challenges assumptions made by the city's developer class, and one they say also takes into account future flooding challenges for Jacksonville. So, for the first time, we're pleased to welcome to Studio 5 the leadership of Riverfront Parks Now, beginning with Nancy Powell, Director of Scenic Jacksonville, on the line. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Melissa.
Good to have you. And Jimmy Orth of the St. John's Riverkeeper. Jimmy, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. How do you think the downtown St. John's River shoreline should be developed? What are your questions for Riverfront Parks Now? Call us up now, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax, and our Facebook page is open. In a moment, we'll talk about what's happening this afternoon at the DIA. But first, Nancy Powell, I'm looking at your website, Riverfront Parks Now, where the homepage says that Jacksonville has a unique once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to turn downtown city-owned property into an iconic riverfront for all. We envision a connected network of extensive public green space and active parks along the riverfront that maximizes public access, reconnects the community to the river, and creates a sense of place. Tell us more about the vision behind Riverfront Parks Now and why you're advocating this, you and the other groups that make up this organization.
Okay, well, great. This our vision is not new. There have been visions previously with Mayor Payton and even in 2015. So we see this as a continuation of that conversation about how to best provide riverfront access to the people of Jacksonville. But about this time last year, a group of us nonprofit leaders were meeting, and we just started having conversations about how to make our downtown riverfront both beautiful and vibrant and be able to protect us from sea level rise. It was not it was not long before that that the landing had been torn down and replaced with grass, and also the courthouse had been torn down and replaced with grass. And we looked at a map that was provided by the DIA, and what we saw was that about 50% of the North Bank Riverwalk at that time and is currently today publicly owned and unencumbered by any developers, contracts. And so, you know, we started talking about and looking at other cities and what lessons could we learn from other cities. And what we quickly saw was that it wasn't just one or two cities, but dozens of mid-sized cities and southern cities have really catalyzed their riverfronts to complement development. It's not opposed to development. And so we saw all of these successful examples, and we pulled together a presentation that we have been giving to community leaders and getting a lot of excitement around that. So again, we see this as a complementary vision, and that the parks and green spaces are critical, especially like in this time of COVID and health and wellness and social equity, to have really our downtown riverfront be accessible for all.
Jimmy Orth, St. John's Riverkeeper, you'll be asking the public to speak out about this at today's Downtown Investment Authority meeting. What's your message to the DIA and the so-called developer class that tends to win these kinds of public arguments in Jacksonville? What are you asking them to do instead?
Well, I think what we want to do is, first of all, I think our parks should be off limits for development. I think that's one of the biggest things that we're trying to get across, is that Metropolitan Park is a park. And just because we failed to invest in it over the last decade or so, and it's not, you know, widely used anymore, it could be. And it provides critical public access to the river. And when that park was developed, I don't know if you remember this, Melissa, but you know, Mayor Godbold, he really envisioned that park as a park for the people, where people of all walks of life could have access to the St. John's River. And we really, as an organization, Riverkeeper in particular, we've really pushed for more access, and we think it's critical. We need more parks along our waterways, not less. And we think it's critical that the parks are not opened up and are not vulnerable to development in the future, because when we establish parks, we typically establish those in perpetuity to benefit generations to come.
Nancy Powell, what about this proposal to build a Four Seasons on the kids' campus site? That's incompatible, it sounds like, with what you would prefer the city do with this property.
Well, we don't want to tell the Four Seasons where they should develop, okay, if that's the plan. It's just that, like Jimmy said, public parks are for the public. And so we think that, there are alternatives for that kind of development. In fact, the most vibrant development that's happening downtown right now is in the core, where historic preservation efforts are happening. And there's a lot of good activity going on. So we don't see that there is, there's plenty of vacant lands and parcels for, developers to consider.
Go
ahead, Jimmy.
I think that's the thing that's really, I think we've got to keep in mind, is Jacksonville is really fortunate compared to a lot of other cities. We're not built out our urban core. We actually have lots of available publicly owned and privately owned properties that currently are undeveloped and available for something like this Four Seasons. So I think that's the thing, is, you know, we really don't need to look to our public parks to build future development. We have available land elsewhere that we can look to. And we can also have this vision that we're talking about, with extensive public green space along our waterfront and adjacent development, because that's the one of the good things Jacksonville has right now, is we have a blank slate of a lot of available properties where we can have both a green waterfront that is publicly accessible, and we can have the development that fills in behind it.
So if we were to keep all of Metropolitan Park intact, should it stay just as it is? Because, you know, I'm lucky enough, Nancy, to work right next door to this whole parcel, and sometimes myself and coworkers will go out and walk through the lawn, the festival lawn area, the kids' campus area. There's a gazebo over there. There's easy access to the water. And you know what? Nobody is ever, ever there. It is absolutely deserted. What if you're successful in convincing the city to keep this as park space, doesn't it need a sprucing up at least to make it more attractive to the public? Nancy.
Of course it does. You know, even in the DIA's plan in 2015, they had a project to redesign Metropolitan Park for all those same reasons. You know, we wouldn't design the kids' campus the same way we designed it that only lasted less than a dozen years. We envision a major reinvestment, which would be a public-private partnership, which other cities have done to make it, you know, to find out from the community, what does the community want in these parks? And, you know, we see that as an anchor to a future expanded vision of an expanded Riverwalk. The Riverwalk never got down to Metropolitan Park. And we understand that the DIA has some plans that they're going to put forth to connect the Riverwalk, which, you know, it's too bad it didn't happen a long time ago, but now is a great time to even do that. You know, there's always a good time to reinvest. And what we've seen in these other cities is the parks are very interesting. They're able to be used. They're designed to be used 365 days a year. So programming is great. Events are great, but their use doesn't depend on having events, right? So they come, you know, that you need both. And,
yeah.
And in the back, that,
the way Hemming Park is now being used, or at least was before the pandemic. Jimmy Orth, before we go to callers, you also are pushing this vision because you say not only is green space an economic development tool, your vision, you say, is more environmentally sustainable for the city because we are facing the threat of more inland flooding. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, exactly. I think we really realized during Hurricane Irma just how vulnerable our city is to sea level rise and storm surge. And so what we've recognized in our research of cities around the world, really, is that cities are turning to green space and parks as a solution, a resiliency solution to help protect their cities, to buffer from storm surge. A lot of cities like New York and Boston actually have comprehensive plans where they're looking at all of their waterfront and how can they take existing parks, make them more resilient, serve as a buffer while they're still providing recreational opportunities for the community, but also help to protect from flooding, to treat stormwater runoff so that it's helping with pollution. That's the thing that we've learned in our research that's so fascinating, is that parks provide so many multiple benefits that the return on investment in most cases is far greater than private development, because you're getting this benefit for the community in terms of health and wellness. It can be a catalyst. We've seen time and time again, these parks serve as a catalyst for development. They actually attract residents, attract businesses, create jobs. They also are a tool for resiliency. So they serve just these multiple co-benefits that can help provide so many, it can solve so many problems in our community, including making us less vulnerable to sea level rise and storm surge.
All right. Well, what are your questions for Riverfront Parks now? 549-2937. Matthew in Riverside. Hi, Matthew. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. I just want to say that Jacksonville has a great opportunity to do the Riverfront Parks Now plan for both world-class green space and for resiliency reasons. And I want to compare the plan to what Chattanooga currently has with the Tennessee Riverwalk, which is over 20 miles long. It's a great space for active engagement with physical activity, and it's great for flooding in the event of any kind of sea level rise for Jacksonville for that kind of plan. If this happens, I feel like it would be much more cost effective than putting development right up at the riverfront. Thank you.
Thanks for that. Let's take another call in Riverside. It's Jim in Riverside. Jim, good morning. Go ahead.
Thanks, Melissa, and good morning to your guests. You know, this keeps being positioned as kind of parks versus developers, and it seems to me that prioritizing the park space and getting that locked in would actually be a boon to developers. They would like it. Wouldn't it increase property values? Wouldn't it give developers more certainty about the areas that they're going to be building in?
Jim, thank you. Nancy Powell, what about that?
Well, if you look at places like, if anybody has been to Chicago, all you have to look at is the, and it's on our website, a picture of the Chicago Grant Park, and the real estate behind, that is behind the park, behind the front lawn, is among the most valuable real estate in Chicago. In St. Petersburg, Florida, they have 6 waterfront districts, and all of them are fronted by green space with the development behind it. So again, we feel like that is, you know, you don't want, if you build at the river, you also have, you will devalue some of the property behind that, right? Because it's going to block people's views. And so you can have both if you set the buildings back and they still get the river views and they get the views of the park and the people get to enjoy the park.
And it sounds like what you're arguing, too, is the city for so long has had this underactivated riverfront and not enough public access. You're saying this accomplishes that goal. You're bringing the public onto the water and increasing the economic return on investment at the same time. Yes?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Sten in on the south side. Sten, hello.
Good morning. Melissa, yes, I like parks, and I agree that there should be public access to the riverfront. The parks tend to be aren't nice, but they tend to be rather passive, as you mentioned about some that we have now. I think what we really need are more cafes and dining, and a lot of riverfront concessionaires, fishing charters, scenic tours, boat rental or instruction sites. Spectator events like the Dragon Boat Tour and other things. I think we need to make the river itself and getting out on the river the big downtown attraction that draws people to downtown. And I don't think that just parks alone do it. We need to make it an activity site.
Thank you for that. Couldn't agree more, Jimmy Orth. That has been the goal for so long in this city, and yet nothing but inertia. What about this vision that you're putting forth? Do you see it as being accommodating of that, of activating the space?
Absolutely. I think Nancy touched on it earlier, is that communities are not building parks now for just event space like we did previously with Metropolitan Park. It was just used primarily for when there was a big event, and the other times of the year, it was not used that widely. That's the thing that these parks around the country are doing, is they're activating. They're turning these parks into 24/7 parks so that there's activities, a multitude of activities too, and opportunities for people to experience the river, different opportunities for recreation, different opportunities to experience the waterways. And I think that is critical. What the previous caller brought up is these parks cannot be just passive parks. They have to be active. I just read a great quote from the commissioner of New York City Parks. And he said that now we can't just be designers and planners. We have to be experience builders. And I think that's part of what it is. It's creating a sense of place, a place people want to be. And there's lots of opportunities to experience the river. And we think that things like cafes and outfitters and kiosks are certainly compatible with a park. But ultimately what the important thing is, I think, that we have to realize is this has to be a shared community vision. That's one of the elements that all of these other cities have incorporated when they've developed and designed their parks, is that the community has to be at the table, and they have to help shape the vision for the waterfront, and then that vision will translate into a comprehensive master plan that helps drive development of those parks and surrounding development for years to come.
Lots of feedback for Riverfront Parks Now on Facebook. Tom writes, restore Metropolitan Park as an entertainment venue. Complete the repairs to Memorial Park. More river access for kayaks and small boats would be good too. Lots of tweets. Here's just one. Why do we have to save Metropolitan Park? Why should we have to fight for something we already own? Jacksonville citizens deserve free access to the river, he tweets. One more tweet. We need more walking and biking areas connected to green space, and that can only be good for the city, our health, and allow Jacksonville to be more singular and compelling. Lots of emails, too. Here's one from Joe. This is a fundamental requirement for Jacksonville to become more of a player in the South, much like Charleston and Savannah. What is the leadership waiting for? He says. Okay, so Nancy Powell, Scenic Jacksonville, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, the DIA meeting is today at 2 o'clock. And let's be clear, it's expected they will approve this request for Mr. Khan and Iguana Investments to do some environmental work on the kids' campus site so that they would then be cleared to potentially develop it. What is your plan for this afternoon for this meeting?
Well, we are going to ask them to remove the parklands from the resolution. The resolution is asking for all of one of the shipyards park, the parcel. There's a parcel east of the Hogan's Creek, the mouth of the Hogan's Creek, that's the shipyards. And again, you know, the Iguana had rights to the shipyards for over 3 years. It expired in 2020. But the parcel on Metropolitan Park, so Metropolitan Park, the 23 acres, is all one real estate parcel. So all we're asking is that they remove that from the resolution.
And let's be clear, when you say you're asking, Riverfront Parks Now is a coalition of the Duval Audubon Society, the Garden Club of Jacksonville, Greenscape, the Urban League, the Late Bloomers Garden Club, the League of Women Voters, Memorial Park Association, Scenic Jacksonville, the Sierra Club, and the St. John's Riverkeeper. Did I get everybody?
I think so. It's 10 nonprofits, and yes.
Okay, so a coalition of local groups, mostly related to gardening and the greening of the city, but not all. And again, this meeting is at 2 o'clock. We'll cover the proceedings, and I want to thank you both so much. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us. Jimmy Orth of the St. John's Riverkeeper, along with Nancy Powell, Director of Scenic Jacksonville. Their website is riverfrontparksnow.org. Thanks to you both, and keep us posted.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa. Have a good day.
You too. Much more still ahead on the show. Meanwhile, later in the hour, some positive news and notes for your midweek. It's our What's Good Wednesdays. That's later. But up next.
Going back to this idea of church, school, and community being integrally connected to who you were, and a part of it being Mr. Bryant, James Bryant himself.
This Black History Month, it's a special event honoring the old Bryant Academy in Yulee, as students who were forced to attend segregated schools in this area went on to excel despite many obstacles. That's next.
From black and white to color TV, from Channel 7 to WJCT, we have been your trusted source for the very best in education, entertainment, and news programming for more than 60 years. But as the way we all watch evolves, so will our name. WJCT-TV will become Jax PBS beginning February 2021. New name, same mission. Educate, involve, inspire.
BritBox and PBS Passport are now offering the best of all your favorite British drama, comedy, and more when you sign up at jacksbundle.com. Start watching today.
Anthology Turntable Tuesday can now be heard at noon and 9 p.m. every Tuesday on the WJCT app and 89.9 HD3. Join us for music from vinyl on Anthology Turntable Tuesday, part of WJCT's Jacksonville Music Experience.
Welcome back. Well, alumni of the old Bryant Academy in Yulee will host a virtual school reunion Saturday, celebrating their educational experiences and proud cultural traditions of what was once an obscure rural community in Nassau County. Now, this reunion is the next step by Bryant alumni in capturing their school's history before it's lost to time. They began by securing a state historic marker for Bryant Academy and creating scholarships so they could pass this history down to the next generation. This is fascinating stuff, and it's actually little known. Bryant was a segregated black school and was subjected to separate and unequal conditions of that time. Yet the Bryant Academy school spirit, embodied in their mascot, the Dragon, produced outstanding students who went on to successful and productive lives both here and abroad. One such alumni is Dr. Joanne Mitchell Martin, founder of the National Museum in Baltimore called Great Blacks in Wax. She is a native of Yulee, and I spoke with her last week. Take a listen. Hi, Dr. Martin. Thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Well, I appreciate the invitation and the opportunity. Thank you.
Of course, you're a native of Yulee and the founder of the National Great Blacks in Wax Museum in Baltimore, Maryland, which is totally fascinating. But we are asking you to appear on the program today to talk about the alumni of Bryant Academy in Yulee and efforts to make this history known to more people. Can you begin by explaining to us what was the Bryant Academy and tell us about the history of this school?
Well, Bryant Academy was the school that evolved from a revenue bond issued by Nassau County in response to the need for better public educational facilities. It was opened in 1950.
And did you attend Bryant Academy?
Yes, I did, from 1953 to 1962.
Wow. Okay. Now, what's interesting as we talk about this in the context of Black History Month is that there's an effort to keep the history of Bryant Academy alive, to have a reunion of classmates and alumni, and also create a historical marker. Tell us what's happening and about these efforts.
The Bryant Academy Grand School Reunion activities will take place on February 20th from noon to 2 o'clock. It's virtual, and so it will be produced, I guess, or made available on YouTube and Facebook, and the unveiling of the historical marker. There is a scholarship program that we instituted, but if looking at people like my brother, for example, who started at the colored school for Nassau County and who eventually went to Bryant Academy, and to talk about the color school movement, because that was very much an important part of the education of African Americans in the United States. The idea that church and school and community were all a part of, an integral part of your upbringing in the days of segregation and within the Black community.
Yes, and I think that's something that we need to mention and that's important to talk about. The students were subjected to separate and unequal conditions, yet the Bryant Academy produced a lot of outstanding students and high-achieving adults, including yourself, right?
Right, and in large part, because I guess going back to this idea of church, school, and community being just integrally connected to who you were, and a part of it being Mr. Bryant, James Bryant himself. For Mr. Bryant, teachers who came to, that he recruited for Bryant Academy, and he recruited the best, they had to become a part of the community. Often they lived in the homes of, especially with segregation where, and I can thank Mr. Bryant, lived in the home of my grandparents. Teachers lived in with families within Yulee. Mm-hmm. And so that was a part of it. They often went to our churches. The activities at the school very much involved the community, and the church was very, very much tied to that. So that was a part of it. But Mr. Bryant's idea, and I know that to be true of other colored principals, he knew that legally and morally, based on separate and equal, that the white men of the colored of the Nassau County School Board were required to give the bare minimum. Mr. Bryant cajoled, pushed, encouraged, flattered, whatever he had to do to get that bare minimum.
Hmm.
And then once he got that, then he went to his parents. And I can remember that they would do what were called sellings. And Mr. Bryant said that their children, our children, as he would have certainly described it, need whatever. Then the parents they started working because Mr. Bryant said that that's what their children needed. Then Mr. Bryant came. Mr. Bryant used to go to Miami-Dade and Tallahassee, and he would see what the more progressive schools were doing, the progressive colored schools were doing. And he had gone to a school in Southern Florida, and they were using a reading improvement machine. And they showed him how it worked. Mr. Bryant came back, and he told our parents that their children needed a reading improvement machine. Our parents, my father was 5 years of schooling, had no idea what a reading improvement machine might be. But Mr. Bryant said, our children need that. And so they're the ladies mainly with the spellings, and he would have the parents in Yulee competing against the parents in Leckby and Sandhill, and then they'd come with this pot of money and say, okay, well, is this enough to get this reading machine that you're talking about? And so we were never deprived of anything simply because the idea was that they were going to give us the bare minimum. Mr. Bryant was going to always take Bryant Academy beyond the bare minimum.
Wow, what amazing recollections. So everybody check this out online. It's coming up on Saturday, February 20th, keeping the legacy of the Bryant Academy in Nassau County alive. Dr. Joanne Mitchell-Martin is an alumnus of the Bryant Academy and founder of the National Great Blacks in Wags Museum in Baltimore. Dr. Martin, thank you for your time today.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that you took the time to allow us to spread the word.
Well, when the pandemic first struck just about a year ago, music venues were among the first businesses to shut down, and they will probably be among the last to reopen. So they really need our help, especially independent venues. Tom DeGeorge of the National Independent Venues Association and owner of the Crowbar in Tampa is on the line with more about the national effort to assist venues and the live music industry. Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me today.
Great to have you. You own the Crowbar, as I said. That's a popular spot over in Ybor City in Tampa. And you are part of this effort. It was initially a piece of legislation that passed Congress last December called the Save Our Stages Act. It was part of the COVID-19 relief bill. And so can you bring us up to date? Because there was this huge effort to get that through Congress and help venues like yours. Where do things stand now with the drive to keep places like your operation open?
Well, I think Tom Petty said it best when he said that the waiting is the hardest part.
Right.
We're waiting and we're struggling, and it's, you know, we've been on this journey since March 15th of last year, venues all over the country, and we fought very hard and worked diligently to become advocacy and lobbyist overnight, and we did get it passed, but unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, the SBA, you know, they're taking their time. slow rolling this out because they want to make sure we believe that the money goes to the people that it was truly intended for. And then on top of that, you know, we have a change in administration. So the timing, unfortunately, which was, you know, already a long time to wait, the timing's just not good for us. So we're hoping the venues can hold on a little bit longer, and we're hoping that they can get the details of how they're going to distribute the grant properly and give us a good application date here very soon.
Let's hope so. We're talking about $15 billion in federal assistance, as you said, coming through the Small Business Administration. This is money well spent. Let's talk about the numbers. The live music industry produced $23.5 billion in annual revenue in 2016. For every dollar one of us spends on a ticket at a small venue, $12 in economic activity comes back to that community in the form of restaurant, tabs, hotels, taxis, and retail. Venues like yours, the Crowbar, drive economic development in Ybor City. And as we look at our area, Northeast Florida, we've got 14 venues in Jacksonville and St. Augustine alone that are members of your organization, the National Independent Venues Association. And some of them, you know, are kind of open now, but they're not at full capacity, like the St. Augustine Amphitheater, the AMP. It can hold nearly 500 people, but as you know, Tom, it's really only operating right now at a third capacity. And so that's the story at most independent venues, isn't it? They're open, but they're limited in how many people they can take in at the gate, which is making it harder for them to stay afloat.
I mean, here in Florida, yes. In some states, the venues are still not open at all. And I think what people need to understand is for our industry to work, and for it to reform itself and come back together, it requires national touring. So until we get to a point where there's a solid reopening strategy and some guidance from the federal government and everybody's open and doing the same thing, tours can't route properly. So that's the other, you know, that's why we need this funding so badly, is because even though we can open here in the state of Florida, we're not going to get the majority of the tours back that we should until the rest of the country is doing the same thing and it's safe to do so. So our industry is just in a much different situation than bars or restaurants or some of the other hospitality and entertainment industries are in, because we actually rely on what everybody else is doing in every other state and making sure that those businesses stay in business in order for the tour industry to even exist. So, you know, the funding's half the battle. It was the first battle that we're still working on, and it's been almost a year. The next step will be figuring out guidance through federal government, through different partners that the tour industry relies on, like the ticketing companies, like the agents and the managers and the venues, and then getting the tour industry started again. It's a long process, but we want to get there.
Sure.
Because everybody misses live music and misses touring.
I know.
We just need to know a safe way to do it.
Certainly the bands miss being able to go out on tour. Owners like you miss it. But let's talk about what this means just for the culture, going beyond the dollars and cents. Going to hear live music is just a joyful experience. And it's one that we need as human beings. And so this is the intangible piece of this. It's just part of our culture. The other night, my daughters were telling me how much they like Neil Young. And they're teenagers. And they listen to all generations, like many generations of music. So I went upstairs and I got an envelope out of my dresser drawer and I showed them all of my old concert tickets that I'd saved since I was 13 years old. And they, all of a sudden, I'm cool in the eyes of my kids because I have a Neil Young concert ticket stub from like 1990-something when he did a solo acoustic show at the Rosemont Horizon in Chicago. And so,
for sure.
You know, I hang on to those concert tickets because they're precious to me. And I think millions of Americans feel the same way. We can't wait for that time when we can go out and see a great show again. So
I agree.
So what? So what's your advice to everyone who supports Save Our Stages and supports this effort? What can the average American do to support this?
I mean, right now it's in the process. I think the most important thing is to make sure that when this money does get distributed, we want to make sure that it actually goes to the venues that need it the most. So if the average American wants to continue to put, I mean, there's really nothing that we can do but wait, you know, because even if they put pressure on their elected officials, it's really in the hands of the SBA right now. So that's what we're waiting for. And then we got to make sure it gets distributed properly. But you're right. Music is the fabric of society. I think that, you know, sports is great, but music is in everything. Music is at sporting events. It's in movies. It's playing when you're at the restaurant. Like, music is continuous. Mm-hmm. So we need to, you know, we just need to get this date from the SBA. I would say if venues are looking for information, they could either go to our website, which is nevaassociation.org, or the sba.gov website, and it'll have continuous information on hopefully when the application date is coming. But there's also frequently asked questions documents on there, so if people are unsure if they're eligible or not, they can go there and look and see what the different criterias are. But right now we're just waiting for that rollout date and then hoping that it gets properly distributed so it helps the venues that it was intended for the most.
Check it out at sba.gov/North Florida to sign up for grant alerts. And NIVA, that website is NIVAassoc.org, NIVAssoc.org. And he is Tom DeGeorge, owner of the Crowbar in historic Ybor City, Tampa, and representing NIVA, the National Independent Venues Association. As you said, the waiting is the hardest part, Tom, but I really hope your wait isn't much longer and that some relief can flow to so many of these independent venues that add so much to cultural life here in our area and yours. So, Tom, thanks so much for your time today and best of luck on getting this resolved soon.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
Yes, we're all looking forward to going back to the Florida Theater, the Amp, Daly's Place, and so many other venues. 1904 Music Hall, Jackrabbits, Lynch's, wherever you like to go to listen to music, Blue Jay. All of those venues need this support, so let's hope that it is in the pipeline pretty soon. All right, a quick break, and still to come, some positive news and notes for your midweek. We rounded up all kinds of good stuff for you. Stuff to make you smile on this Wednesday. It's our What's Good Wednesdays, and that is coming up in just a moment. A quick break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9. Don't go away.
Announcing Vickers Landing at Oak Bridge, bridging retirees with an all-new Ponte Vedra Beach community featuring new homes, a resort lifestyle, and a life plan for every stage of aging. Information at VickersLanding.com.
Florida Education Association, which works to keep communities connected during the pandemic. FEA believes that public schools are essential to both in-person and remote learning for every child in every zip code. FEA.org.
On the next Fresh Air, the hidden costs of racism for everybody. We speak with Heather McGee, former president of the progressive think tank Demos. She says racial discrimination in housing, employment, and voting rights in America has harmed white people as well as African Americans. She's written a new book called The Sum of Us. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Today's teenagers are, of course, tomorrow's workers. And this year, the one that just passed, oh, it's been tough on them.
It's very easy to just stay in your room all day and not let anybody know what's happening to you.
I'm Kai Rizdal. The pandemic, as seen by a high school senior, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Donald Trump says his movement has only just begun, and he's going after lawmakers who voted to impeach. But state and local prosecutors are now coming after him. Some members of his own party think he should face charges in court. But where, when, and on what grounds can we expect the former president to take the stand? Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, it's Wednesday, so that means it's time for our weekly look around town at what's good on the First Coast. Yes, it's our What's Good Wednesdays, and we're going to begin far, far away in outer space, as a matter of fact. Yeah. How about this? Tomorrow, the Mars rover Perseverance is going to attempt a daring sky crane landing on the red planet, similar to the one aced by its predecessor, the rover Curiosity, in August of 2012. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I spoke with a local NASA ambassador. Yes, there is such a thing. His name is Bharat Mutiala, and he told me all about this latest Mars rover.
I'm so excited. I think everybody who has seen those previous rovers, like the Mars rovers landed on the Mars, they may be definitely excited doing those the surface experiments, sending those beautiful images. I think everybody excited, and I'm excited.
You can tell, you can feel his excitement. Now, Perseverance is also carrying a light helicopter called Ingenuity for test flying on Mars's light atmosphere, Mutiala told me. And they're even carrying a special plate to honor the dedication and hard work of the medical community and first responders around the globe. Apparently a middle school student came up with the name Perseverance for this rover. I like that too. Make sure to stream the landing attempt at NASA's website. You can watch the whole thing. And no, they won't be providing us any images of Matt Damon growing little plants with manure inside a white tent for your enjoyment. At least not this time. Well, 2020 was nothing if not divisive. So Northeast Florida's Area Agency on Aging, ElderSource, is pushing against that with a campaign encouraging love, unity, and respect. Their Share the Love Challenge encourages people of all ages to exchange kindness in the form of little words, gestures, and deeds. Just random acts of kindness, says CEO Linda Levin. She says that her staff is having such a hard time right now dealing with helping seniors who are so concerned about COVID-19. Her staff is anxious, so are all the seniors. Before the pandemic, ElderSource's helpline got about 6,000 calls a month. She says they're up to more than 8,500 calls each month now, showing that we could all do more to help our seniors in this community. Check it out at their website. Well, every year, more than 200,000 people in the U.S. die in hospitals from what are considered preventable deaths. And even more light has been shed on this problem as healthcare workers have been overwhelmed with COVID-19. Thousands of healthcare workers have lost their lives due to COVID infections while trying to take care of their patients and the community. So to raise awareness about the importance of healthcare worker and patient safety during this pandemic and to honor those on the front line, a guy named Dr. Dave Mayer, CEO of the global group Patient Safety Movement Foundation, decided to walk, yes, walk across the entire United States. Dr. Mayer started his journey in San Diego last year, and he's finishing up today in Jacksonville Beach after crossing the bottom tier of America on foot for nearly a year. Now, I spoke with him yesterday, just as he was finishing up his long journey from the west to the east coast on foot.
I was frustrated that people didn't seem to recognize that preventable medical harm was the third leading cause of death each year behind cancer and heart disease. I just felt I had to do something drastic, and I happened to watch Forrest Gump one night and had a glass of wine in me and said, you know what, I'm going to walk virtually across the country in memory of those who lost their lives to preventable medical harm, patients, as well as caregivers.
He just started walking, just like Forrest Gump. Yeah, when he hits the East Coast finish line at Jacksonville Beach later today, Dr. Mayer says he will plant 200 orange flags in the sand. It's a symbol. Orange is the World Health Organization color for patient safety around the world, and the flags are in honor of many who have died. You can learn more at the Patient Safety Movement Foundation's website or look for Dr. Dave Mayer out on Jacksonville Beach later today. Well, finally, if you're a fan of honey, we want you to make sure to listen in to tomorrow's show when we interview the great people over at Bee Friends Farm. This is an amazing local company that's sort of been mobile for several years, but they are setting up a brick and mortar store this month in Murray Hill where they will sell honey, beeswax, and other products made from local beehives. Some very sweet economic development news for Murray Hill. And if you're a fan of good news, hey, just send us some. Email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, and we will make an effort, if it fits, to include it in our What's Good Wednesday segment and our e-newsletter, and that goes out later today. If you'd like to subscribe to that, just go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org website, and that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to all of our guests and callers, including producer Heather Schatz, Josh Torres, our show director, news director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News, 89.9 Jacksonville. You can catch our podcast later today wherever you like to listen or through the WJCT app. And we'll be right back here doing all of this again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Keep masking up, everyone, and have a great Wednesday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.